19. All places hell. When all the world dissolves, and every creature shall be purified, all places shall be hell, that is not heaven. Christopher Marlowe, Dr. Faustus. By the time Lucy and Thomas reached Chiswick House, it was near dark. The sun had set, and the mansion was tarnished silver against the dying light. Leaving the carriage at the curb, they made their way in silence up the long road, flanked by twisted trees to the main house. Somehow the place looked worse than it had when Lucy had been here with Cordelia. Lucy could see the humped shadow of the greenhouse in the distance and the ruined Italian gardens in the other direction. Seeing the manor and its grounds in better light, Lucy wished she had not. She couldn't imagine living in such a house.
"Poor Grace," she said. "This place is a rat hole. Actually, I wouldn't wish it on a rat."
"That is because you like rats," said Thomas. "Remember Mari?" Mari Curie had been a small white rat Christopher had kept in the room at the Devil Tavern and fed on bread and chicken bones. Mari had been friendly enough to rest on Lucy's shoulder and nuzzle at her hair. Eventually, Mari had died of natural causes and been buried with pomp and circumstance in Matthew's back garden.
"But I don't know if we ought to feel sorry for Grace," said Lucy. "She broke James's heart."
"For someone with a broken heart, he seems in remarkably fine fettle," said Thomas.
"Honestly, he actually seems more cheerful."
Lucy could not deny that this was true.
"Still," she said, "it is the principle of the thing."
They reached the greenhouse, a long structure of glass and wood. Long ago it had provided the Lightwood family with pineapples and grapes in winter. Now there were holes smashed into the glass walls, and the once clean windows were smeared and dark. A massive padlock hung on the door. Lucy started to reach for her steely, but Thomas put a hand on her wrist.
"I can go around the back," he said. "There ought to be a small shed there with an entrance into the greenhouse. They would have needed to heat the place by hypocaust." "I have no idea what you mean," said Lucy. "But I suspect you know this because of all the hours you've spent listening to Christopher in the lab." "Certainly, by all means, let us crawl into a dark and spider-infested shed."
"It isn't spiders I'm worried about," said Thomas. "And you won't be doing any crawling. We need you out here as sentry. If you see any unusual activity, send up an alarm."
"I hate being the watchman. Are you certain we need one?"
"Yes," said Thomas, "because if one of us is going to be devoured by demonic tree roots, then the other one had better be around to get help, or at least grab the mallows root and run for it." Lucy had to admit he had a point.
"Go on, then."
Thomas headed toward the back of the greenhouse. Lucy attempted to do as he had suggested for at least 5 minutes, but it was very dull. There was only so long one could pace back and forth in front of the door to a greenhouse before feeling like a goldfish swimming to and fro in its bowl. She was very nearly relieved to glimpse something out of the corner of her eye. It looked like a spark of bright light down toward the Italian gardens. She moved away from the greenhouse, narrowing her eyes. The light was pale in colour and wavering against the twilight. A torch, perhaps? She moved closer, keeping to the shadows. The gardens were a ruin. Once there had been neat hedgerows, but they were all overgrown now, a mess of shrubbery leading in all directions. The marble statues of Virgil, Sophocles and Ovid had been smashed to jagged pieces that protruded upward from broken plinths. In the centre of the whole mess was a square brick structure, like an old storage shed. As she moved toward it, she saw the flicker of light once again. It was stronger now, and seemed to be rising over the walls of the small structure, as if it had no roof, though that was not unusual for old buildings. The roof was often the first thing to go. It certainly had no windows,
but the light continued to shine steadily from within. Consumed by curiosity, Lucy reached the square little building and stared. It appeared to have been built long ago, of large and sturdy stone. There was a door in one side, though it was closed. Light gleamed beneath the door. As Lucy watched, the light moved. Someone, or something, was very definitely inside. Throwing caution to the wind, Lucy began to climb one of the walls. She reached the top almost immediately. The structure was indeed roofless, open to the elements despite the four thick walls. Lucy flattened herself atop the wall she'd climbed and stared down into the space below. It was a single room, bare of any decoration save a sword hanging upon one wall. It bore a crosspiece carved with thorns, the symbol of the Blackthorn family. In the centre of the room was a table, on which rested a coffin. Standing beside the coffin was Grace Blackthorn, a witchlight torch in her right hand. Her left hand lay atop the coffin, her slim fingers outspread, as if she could reach through the glass front and touch the body within. For the coffin was made of glass, like the coffin of Snow White in fairy tales. And lying within it was Jessie Blackthorn, hair as black as ebony, skin as white as snow. His lips were not as red as blood, though. They were pale and set, and his eyes were closed. He wore a suit of funeral white. It was jarring to see him in something other than the clothes he had died in, and his hands were crossed over his chest. Lucy gripped the wall tightly. Jessie's body! It had probably only been in this shed a short time. Tatiana would have kept her son with her in Idris until they came to London. But why hadn't she simply put Jessie inside the main house, rather than in this odd little structure, somewhere where there would have been a roof over him? The thought of cold rain falling on his coffin was almost painful. Jessie didn't look dead. He looked as if sleep had found him as he lay at rest in a garden. He looked as if he might rise at any moment and step free of his glass prison. He looked alive. "Jessie," Grace said. "Jessie, I'm afraid." Lucy froze. She had never heard Grace speak like this. Grace sounded afraid, it was true, but more than that, she sounded gentle. "Jessie, I'm sorry. I hate to leave you out here in the cold, even though I know you don't feel it." Grace sounded as if she were fighting tears. "Charles is always wandering around the inside of the manor. I suppose he wants to see what kind of property he will inherit when Mama dies." Her voice dropped. Lucy had to lean down to hear her. "Oh, Jessie, I am afraid they are going to stop me coming here at night. Charles is constantly saying that I shouldn't be alone in this tumble-down house. He doesn't know that I'm not alone. You come to talk to me." She drew her lace-gloved hand back from the coffin. "You asked me why I'm marrying Charles. You asked if it was because I feared what Mama might do to James." Lucy froze. In the near darkness, it was impossible to see Grace's expression. It seemed to change as the witchlight flickered, gentle one moment, vicious the next. "But I am so much more selfish than that," breathed Grace. "I am doing it because it will free me from Mama. I want her to recover, I truly do. But when she does, I must have her realize that I am part of the Consul's family now and can't be touched. As for James..." The shadows thickened in the small room below. Behind Grace, there was only darkness. Lucy knew she should return to the greenhouse, but she was desperate to hear more of what Grace was saying. "You have asked me so many times what I truly felt for James, and I never told you. I hid so much from you. I always wished to show you my best face, Jessie. You were the only one who ever spoke up for me against Mama. I wish..." The shadows behind Grace seemed to move. Lucy gasped. Grace looked up at the noise, just as a crouching shape emerged from the darkness. It was a demon, half reptilian and half human, with leathery bat's wings and a sharply pointed chin like the tip of a knife. It loomed above Grace, massive and scaled, and she shrieked aloud, dropping her witchlight torch. She began to back away, but the demon was too swift. Its leathery claw shot out. It seized Grace by the throat and lifted her off the ground. Her small feet in their heeled boots kicked wildly. The demon spoke, its voice echoing off the brick walls. "Grace Blackthorn, you foolish girl!" In the light from the torch, Lucy could see that its face was flat, snake-like, its ovoid eyes glittering like black stones. It had two mouths, but only the lower one moved as it spoke. Great horns curved up from either side of its head, sheened with black and grey scales. "You should never have betrayed the oaths your mother swore to those far more powerful than she. Some enchantments are not yours to remove. Do you understand?"
"It had already begun to fade," Grace gasped. "It was not working."
She must be talking about the enchantments placed on Jessie, Lucy thought. Maybe something had happened to them when Tatiana had succumbed to the poison.
"You will do as you're told. Put the enchantment back where it was. I, Namtar, will see to its strengthening."
Its voice was like gravel.
"Otherwise, when our master finds out it was removed, his wrath will be beyond your imagining. Remember, all you care for can be destroyed with one word from him, with one flick of his wrist."
Its free hand shot out toward the coffin containing Jessie. Grace cried out, and Lucy flung herself from the wall, landing hard on the demon's back, her arms about its neck. With a roar of surprise, the demon staggered back, releasing Grace. She landed hard, her eyes feral, her fair hair straggling about her face. The demon snarled and ducked its head, as if to sink its teeth into Lucy's hands. She let go, dropping to the ground, and seized Grace by the wrist. Grace stared at her in frozen astonishment.
"What are you doing here?"
This did not seem to Lucy to be the most pressing issue at hand. She gritted her teeth and yanked Grace toward the door.
"Run, Grace!"
At the sound of her name, Grace snapped free of her paralysis. She began to run, tugging Lucy after her. They burst through the door and into the garden. Grace let go of Lucy and swung around to slam the door shut behind them, but the demon had already seized it from the other side. There was a shriek of metal as the door was torn from its hinges and flung aside. The demon advanced on the two girls. Lucy had half expected Grace to bolt for the house, but she was standing her ground. Lucy tugged a seraph blade free of her belt, just as Grace bent, seized up a rock, and flung it at the demon. Lucy had to give her points for enterprise, at least. The rock bounced off the demon's leathery chest. It grinned with both mouths and seized Lucy around the torso, sending her seraph blade flying. She was lifted off her feet as the demon's black gaze raked her up and down. Its eyes narrowed.
"I know you," it snarled.
It sounded almost surprised.
"You are the second one."
Lucy kicked out, her feet connecting hard with the demon's torso. It grunted, and she shrieked in pain as its grip tightened. Its lower mouth opened. She saw the glint of fangs, and then a flood of black as ichor poured forth. Staggering, it released Lucy. She fell to the ground and rolled aside as the demon's body arched backward. The blade of a sword emerged from its chest, smeared with green-black ichor.
It looked down incredulously at the steel protruding from its torso, snarled, and vanished. Standing just behind where the demon had been was Jesse. He held the sword that had hung on the wall in the tiny coffin room. Though there was ichor on the blade and spattered on the ground at his feet, there were no stains on his clothes or on his bare hands. The sky was black above. His green eyes glittered as he slowly lowered the sword.
"Jesse," Lucy breathed.
She broke off as Grace took a staggering step forward. Her gaze darted from Lucy to Jesse and back again, her expression incredulous.
"But I don't understand," she said,
gripping one hand with the other.
"How can you see Jesse?"
James had thought Matthew and Cordelia still might try to prevent him, but after he explained, the words echoing in his own ears as he told them how he had put the pieces of it all together, he knew that they would not. Both stared at him with drained, pale faces, but neither made a move to stand between him and the gateway. Matthew, dishevelled, dirty, still with his incongruous spats on, drew himself up, his chin high. "Then if you must go, I will go with you," he said. James's heart broke. How could he do this to Matthew? How could he contemplate dying in a place Matthew could never follow him to? And yet, "It won't work," he said softly. "No one can follow me into the shadows, Math. Not even you." Matthew walked swiftly toward the archway, even as James called out to him in sharp alarm. He reached out to touch the empty space below the arch, where the green ground of the cemetery turned to ash and greyness. His hand bounced back, as if he had slammed it into glass. He turned back to face his companions, and Cordelia saw that he was shaking. "Cordelia, do you have rope?" he said. Cordelia still had the rope they had used to climb to Garst's window. Matthew took it from her. As James and Cordelia looked on, mystified, he secured one end of the rope around James's waist. Despite the shaking of his hands, he tied an excellent knot. The other end of the rope he secured around his own waist. When he was done, he looked steadily at James. "Go on then," he said. "If something happens, you need us to pull you back through. Tug on the rope 3 times. "I will," James said. He turned to Cordelia. He was standing so close to the archway that the outline of his left side seemed greyed out, as if he were a sketch that was rapidly being erased. "Cordelia." Cordelia leaned over and kissed James swiftly on the cheek. She saw him blink and touch his fingers to the spot in surprise. "Come back," she said. James nodded. There was nothing more for any of them to say. With a last look behind him, James stepped through the archway and disappeared. The world beyond the archway was black and grey. James moved first through amorphous shapes and then into a place where a path wound between dunes of dry sand. The air was thick and acrid and tasted of smoke, and dust seemed to blow ceaselessly through the air, forcing him to shield his eyes with one hand. Just above him, he could see a hole in the grey-black clouds and strange constellations of stars. They gleamed like the eyes of spiders. Some distance away, clouds had gathered and black rain was falling. His only comfort was the rope around his waist. Like all Shadowhunter rope, its reach was much longer than it appeared. It unrolled and unrolled behind him with no sign of running out. He kept tight hold of it with his right hand. Somewhere on the other end were Matthew and Cordelia. After some time, the landscape changed. For the first time, he saw the ruins of what had once been a civilization. Broken pillars littered the dry ground, along with the crumbling remains of old stone walls. In the far distance, he thought he could make out the shape of a watchtower. The path curved around a dune. When James emerged from the other side, he could see the tower more clearly. It rose like a spear against the torn sky. In front of him was a square, surrounded by the ruins of walls, and in the middle of the square stood a man. He was dressed all in white, like a morning shadow hunter. His hair was a pale grey colour, though he did not look old. It was the colour of dove's feathers, cut unfashionably long. His eyes were a familiar steel grey. James recalled the illustration of the princes in the book he had studied, but those had been monstrous depictions. This was a prince of hell, showing himself in his most human form. He looked like a statue carved by a divine hand. His features were ageless, handsome, everything in balance. It was possible to see in his face the terrible beauty of the fallen. Even his hands looked as if they had once been shaped for acts of divinity, for prayer and holy war at once. "Hello, grandfather," James said. The demon came toward him, smiling courteously. The acrid wind ruffled his pale hair. "You know who I am, then?"
"You are Belial," said James.
"What a clever boy," said Belial. "I have taken great care to leave no trace behind me."
His hand described a graceful parabola in the air. His knuckles were like curved hinges.
"But then, you are my grandson."
"But this is not your realm," said James. "It was Belphegor's realm, was it not? And you took it from him."
Belial chuckled benignly.
"Poor Belphegor," he said. "I wounded him quite gravely when he was not expecting it. No doubt he is still floating about in the space between the worlds, trying to find his way home. Not a nice fellow, Belphegor. I wouldn't waste your sympathy on him."
"It isn't sympathy," said James. "I thought at first perhaps Belphegor was my grandfather. But it didn't fit. Not quite. Then a Galia rept said that his master's realm had been taken from him."
"You met a Galia rept?"
Belial seemed highly amused.
"What a fellow.
We spent some good times together before he got himself trapped in that box. You do move in interesting circles, James." James ignored this. "And I started to think, who would steal a whole world? And why?" He watched Belial's face for any change, but the Prince of Hell betrayed no emotion. "Then I remembered reading a book that mentioned you."
"Many books mention me," said Belial.
"This one called you the thief of realms, of worlds, and I thought it was a mistake, that it had meant to say you were the greatest thief in all the worlds, in any world. But it was correct, wasn't it? You steal realms. You stole this realm from Belphegor." James felt dizzy. His wrist, where Christopher's nails had scored him, ached and throbbed. "You thought no one would guess you were behind the demon attacks. You thought that if you left traces, they would be ascribed to Belphegor. What I don't understand is that all my life you have been showing me this place, this realm." He broke off, fighting for control. "I see this world whether I wish to or not. But why show me a realm that isn't yours?"
Belial grimaced. "You are mortal, and you measure out your lives in days and years. We demons measure our lives in centuries and millennia. When I wrested this place from my brother, there were no shadow hunters. They were not even a thought in Raziel's stupid, pretty little head. Over the centuries I have bent everything in this realm to my will. Every tree, every rock, every grain of sand is under my command, and so, my boy, are you. That is why I brought you here."
"I came here of my own free will," said James. "I chose to meet you face to face."
"When did you know I was not Belphegor?"
James suddenly felt weary. "Does it matter?
I guessed some of it when the Mandakor on the bridge spoke to me. There was no reason for a prince of hell to want to see me so badly unless we shared blood, and no reason for him to be so cagey about which prince he was unless he was playing some sort of trick. A Galiarept said his master's realm had been stolen by a more cunning demon, and I had heard my grandfather called Hell's most cunning prince. When Ariadne spoke, when she called her master the Lord of Thieves, I knew it. The Mandakor's master, the thief, the cunning prince, my grandfather. They were one and the same. And who do you think spoke to you through Ariadne and the others? Said Belial. He waved a lazy hand in the air, and for a moment, James glimpsed the infirmary in the silent city. The sick were lying motionless in their beds, Jem guarding the archway, his staff in his hand. The room was silent. James could not help but gaze at Christopher, still and bruised-looking. "I have grown tired of your dawdling," Belial said, lowering his hand. The vision blinked out of existence. "You needed to understand that if you did not come to me, the dying would never stop." James thought of Matthew and Cordelia, how they had stared at him in disbelief when he had told them why he had to go through the gateway, why he had no choice. "I must meet my grandfather in his realm, whether it is a trap or not. Some traps must be sprung, for if I do not meet him and bargain with him, there will never be an end to this death." "You were the reason there have been so few demons all these years in London," said James. "Too scared to show their faces," Polly had said. "They stayed away because they were afraid of you. But why?"
"To make you all soft," Belial said. "The Mandakor has cut through you like a knife through bread, and why not? You remember nothing of what it means to be warriors."
"And then you started to let the demons back in," James said slowly, "to keep us anxious and distracted, not paying attention."
Belial flicked sand from his sleeve. "You and your friends seem to have been paying quite a bit of attention." James spoke coldly. "We humans are not such fools as you think." Belial's smile widened. "You have me all wrong, child, if you think I feel that humans are foolish," he said. "They are heaven's most beloved creation. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god," he quoted softly. "The beauty of the world. The paragon of animals." "Shakespeare," said James, "was being sarcastic." "You are not truly human regardless, are you?" said Belial. "No Nephilim is. You walk among humans, you look like them, but the powers of even the lowest among you exceed the strongest human being." James wasn't sure what he had been expecting of Belial. This attitude toward human beings was not it. But demons were tricky creatures, like fairies in that way. They twisted and shaped truth to their own purposes. And demons, unlike fairies, could lie. "Why did you want to meet me so badly?" James said, keeping his voice neutral. "And why not come to me? Why did you insist I come to you?" Belial threw his head back, but if he laughed, it made no sound. "You are a surprise," he said. "Did you expect more fear?" said James. "Then you do not know my father. You do not know my mother. You do not know my family or me." "I expected more anger," said Belial. "But perhaps you have moved past such things. You do seem to know about me already. You Nephilim and all your little books. What have you learned about your grandfather then?" "You made Belial for the pit, angel of enmity. In darkness is his domain. His counsel is to bring about wickedness and guilt. All the spirits of his lot are angels of destruction. They walk in the laws of darkness. Towards it goes their only desire," James quoted. Belial seemed amused.
Did you not also learn the meaning of my name? Beli-ya'al, in the original Aramaic. Or is it Hebrew? It means never to rise. I alone among the princes of hell cannot walk on earth in my own form. I must possess a body in order to exist in your realm. You possessed Ariadne, James said, in the sick room. Only for a moment, Belial said bitterly. When my spirit possesses a human body, it is like a bonfire burning within a fragile casing of paper. The body will be destroyed within hours. Lilith, Samael, all the others they can walk upon earth, even in their own forms. Only I am thus restricted, for heaven punishes us all according to its lights. I, of all the princes, loved human beings most, so I alone am separated from walking among them. As he spoke, he gestured. His hands were as beautiful and ageless as the rest of him, with slim, long fingers. His nails were matte black. And then there is you. The burning had intensified in James's veins. He could feel fever sweat trickling between his shoulder blades, dampening his hair. He did not dare look down at his arm. The only other host body I can use, said Belial, is one of my own blood. I tried with your mother, but that clockwork angel she wore prevented me from getting near her. Even when it was gone, Ithuriel protected her. She is too poisoned with angel blood to make a home for me. His lip curled. But you, we could share your body, James. My presence would cure the Mandacore venom in your veins. You would live, and the power you would have would be immense. For are you not my heir, my own flesh and blood? James shook his head. The demon attacks, the sickness, you caused all of it because you need me to be willing. The last piece of the puzzle fell into place. James's whole body throbbed with pain. This is why you wanted Belphegor to be blamed for what you've been trying to do. For all of this, you've been trying to get around the law that says you cannot rise. You were never trying to fool us, the shadow hunters, about who my grandfather was. You were trying to fool the others like you. Angels above and demons of the pit, said Belial, examining his black nails. Indeed, I don't deny that. You need me to volunteer myself for possession, to allow you to become me. Quite, said Belial. He looked bored. You took my grandmother's happiness from her. You took my cousin Barbara's life, and you want me to...
To give me your body for my rising, said Belial impatiently. Yes, yes, because I can make it all stop. My creature on the bridge told you as much.
The Mandacore, said James. You possessed someone and sent them to Emmanuel Garst, had him raise the demon.
Garst was a useful idiot, said Belial. He somehow thought that after he raised the demon I would let him live, though the trail would have led to him eventually, and he's hardly the sort who could withstand torture or interrogation.
He yawned.
It's really too bad. Garst was quite talented at dimensional magic. He managed to raise the Mandacore in such a way that it exists partly in your world and partly here, where it thrives.
That's why it can withstand sunlight in our world, James said.
Precisely. Worlds are layered upon one another. The Mandacore and its children are shielded in your realm by this one, and here it serves me completely. When I order it to cease attacking Nephilim, the attacks will stop. The deaths will stop. But if you refuse me, they will continue. And you, my boy, will die.
Stop the demon first, James rasped. Bring him forth and destroy him, and you can possess me. I'll let you.
No, purred Belial. That is not how these things work, James Herondale. This is my realm, and there will be no tricks. First,
you become my host. Then...
James shook his head.
No, the demon first. And you cannot just rescind your orders to the creature. You must destroy it.
Belial's icy gaze hardened. His eyes are so much like my mother's, James thought. It was strange to see those eyes filled with so much evil, so much hate.
It is not your place to give me orders, said Belial. Come here, boy.
James didn't move. Belial's eyes narrowed, then flicked over him, taking in his face, his gear, his bleeding wrist.
You refuse me, he said slowly, almost as if he could not quite believe it.
James would have said he seemed aghast, if princes of hell could be aghast.
As I said before, said James, I came here of my own free will.
I see, Belial said. You are not as tractable as I had been led to believe, but you will realize the wisdom of my plans soon enough. I would prefer an adult male body, he added, almost as an aside. In fact, I would prefer you were a bit older, but needs must as the devil drives, as they say. He grinned. Recall that you are not the only one I could approach.
He waved a black nailed hand, and multicolored light streaked across the dark air. It resolved into the shape of Lucy. Lucy in gear, her hair up in a determinedly tight chignon. She looked exactly herself, down to the ink stains on her hands. James's stomach clenched.
Don't you dare touch her, he said. Besides, Lucy would never agree.
Belial laughed.
Don't be so sure.
Consider it, James. Despite the strength in your blood, the body you occupy is frail. Look what you are dying of now. 4 small nail marks in your arm. So very little to end so much. You reside in a flimsy shell that can age and die and feel terrible pain. But if you joined with me, you would become immortal. Would you not want that for your sister? For yourself?
No, said James. It would not be worth it.
Ah, the foolish confidence of Nephilim.
Belial's eyes narrowed.
Perhaps it is time for me to remind you, boy, just how fragile you truly are.
There was a silence. Jesse stood, not breathing hard, not breathing at all, the sword in his hand. He looked from Grace to where Lucy crouched, still on the ground. He inclined his head toward Lucy then, in the smallest of nods. She turned to Grace.
Yes, Lucy said. I can see Jesse.
Grace's hand flew to her mouth.
But how? She whispered. James is a Herondale too, but can't see him. James could never see him.
Lucy is unusual, said Jesse. She seems to be able to see more than ordinary ghosts. He propped the sword against the side of the shed and went over to his sister.
Grace, he said, gently putting his arms around her.
Grace laid her head against his shoulder. That demon, was that grandfather's work, still lingering about?
Grace drew back slightly.
No, she said. It was...
She shook her head.
It isn't safe. We can't speak in front of her, not about anything. She's the daughter of Will Herondale, Jesse. She's practically the consul's niece.
Lucy rose silently, brushing grass from her clothes. She felt very awkward. She thought of the demon, its hissing whisper. The oaths your mother swore to those far more powerful than she. The demon had been Tatiana's doing, she knew, and she suspected from the look on his face that Jesse guessed it too.
I know, Lucy, Jesse said, looking at Lucy over the top of Grace's blonde head. I trust her, just as you trust James.
Grace drew back and frowned.
I've never told him about you.
Lucy?
A voice called her name. She looked up to see Thomas racing toward her. He cleared the low hedge easily and approached, looking puzzled but ready for a fight, bolus in his hand. Grace stepped back hastily from Jessie, wiping at her face. She turned to glare at Thomas. "Why have you invaded my home?" she demanded. "What is going on here?"
"We didn't think you'd be at home," Thomas said.
"Not helpful," said Lucy. "Tell her about the antidote, Thomas."
"Ah," said Thomas, looking nervously at Grace. "Christopher and I have been trying to work out an antidote for the demonic poison."
"And?" said Grace in a clipped tone. She was watching Jessie out of the corner of her eye. He had retreated several feet and was looking at them silently. It seemed clear Thomas could not see him.
"We needed something from your greenhouse," said Thomas. "A particular plant. I retrieved it, and I suspect it will not be missed, given the state of the conservatory."
Jessie raised his eyebrows. "Do you make a habit of breaking into people's houses and insulting their gardening?" demanded Grace. "And why was Miss Herondale in the Italian gardens?" "I..." Lucy began.
The world went white. White, then grey.
Lucy gasped as the garden in front of her vanished, replaced with a vast desert and a night sky blooming with unfamiliar stars. In front of her, she could see James, his clothes spattered in blood. He looked ill, sick and feverish. As she stared in shock, he lunged forward with a blade in his hand. The vision disappeared. She was back on the grounds of the manor in Chiswick, her body doubled up, fighting for breath. What she had seen was real. She knew it.
"James," she choked. "James is in some sort of trouble. We have to help him."
But she could not say that in front of Thomas. He had to concentrate on the antidote, and besides, he would think she was mad. She tried to steady her voice.
"I should join him."
Thomas looked puzzled. So did Grace. Only Jessie seemed to understand. "Where is he now?" said Jessie. "I'll go check on him. You know how quickly I travel." Lucy and Grace exchanged a quick, almost conspiratorial look.
"Where is James, by the by?" Grace asked loudly. "Is he not with you?" "He is in Highgate Cemetery," said Lucy. "He went to the Silent City."
Jessie gave a short nod and vanished.
"What on earth, Lucy?" said Thomas. "What's this about James?" "I should join him in Highgate," said Lucy. "I will be more help to our friends there than I will be to you in the laboratory. Now that we have the last ingredient, time is of the essence in creating this antidote, is it not?"
"Yes, but must you go to Highgate now?"
"I just feel I ought to be with him, and with Cordelia. We've done what we came for here. I'll only be a distraction to you in the lab."
"Lucy may borrow our pony trap," Grace said quickly. "It should suffice to get her to the Silent City if she wishes." Surprised, Lucy shot her a grateful look. Thomas looked torn.
"I ought to go with you, Lucy."
"No," Lucy protested. "Tom, you must go to the consul's house. I could not live with myself if the antidote was delayed on my account."
Which, Lucy thought, was certainly true. Thomas was persuaded at last to bid farewell and headed back toward the manor's long drive. As soon as he was out of earshot, Grace bent a hard gaze on Lucy.
"What are you planning? I know you sent him away for a reason. A real one." "I sent him away because of Jessie," Lucy said. "And because I heard you talking to that demon, Grace. It was threatening you about some spell. The clave."
Grace had gone an awful sort of colour. In books, when people went pale, it was dramatic. In this moment, the sight made Lucy feel a little sick.
"Do not even say their name," she said.
"Yes, my mother invoked black magic to try to bring my brother back. And with black magic came demons. Demons with whom she made bargains. Demons with demands, exacting promises.
I wish to the angel she had not done any of it.
I tried to keep the worst of it from Jesse, but I... He is all I have, and I cannot lose him. If the Clave learned of my mother's doings... I know, Lucy said, trying for a calmer tone. I understand that no one can know Jesse is here. That you're hiding him because if the Nephilim found his body, they'd destroy it. But he must be hidden, protected. The Enclave didn't find him when they searched the grounds here. Mama kept Jesse's coffin in her bedroom, and the Enclave did not enter there, said Grace in a near whisper. I moved him after she became ill. I couldn't bear to go in there, and I couldn't bear for him to have to wake there every sunset. That's awful, Lucy began. Then she gave a cry of surprise as Jesse reappeared. Grace, clearly more used to Jesse's ghostly comings and goings, looked unruffled. Did you find him? Lucy asked immediately. Did you see James? Jesse hesitated. I did not see him, but I did see Matthew and Cordelia. James was missing. That's all. James was missing, Lucy demanded. Matthew and Cordelia would not leave him.
I think he left them, if he even chose to go, said Jesse slowly. There were remnants of dark magic there.
Lucy's stomach clenched. We must get to them. Now. You could take our trap, as I suggested, Grace said, though Lucy noticed she did not offer to come with her. No, thank you, but... Lucy turned to Jesse. Please, can you take me with you? The way you travel? Jesse was taken aback.
The way ghosts travel, he said. I've no idea if it would work, Lucy. I've never brought anyone with me.
Lucy put her hand out. Jesse was standing close to her, and she could rest her palm upon his chest. He was solid, his skin soft where her fingers brushed against his collarbone. But there was no heartbeat beneath her hand. She looked into his eyes. He might never forgive her for this, she knew, but she had no choice. Jesse Blackthorne, she said, I command you to bring me with you to my brother. Take me to Highgate Cemetery. He stiffened.
Lucy, no.
Grace took a step toward them, looking puzzled. She began to reach out her hand toward Jesse. I command it, Lucy said fiercely. With a look of fury on his face, Jesse pulled her into his arms, and the ground disappeared beneath her feet.